Pillar 2 of the trilateral agreement known as AUKUS is focused on cooperative actions between the three nations to develop advanced defense capabilities, which are critical to the balance of power in future strategic competition with China. AUKUS Pillar 2's potential for establishing and maintaining advantages in critical technology areas can only be fulfilled if the alliance can demonstrate progress and overcome barriers to cooperation. As strategic competition continues to intensify, what can we expect from AUKUS Pillar 2 cooperation and emerging technologies? And how is Australia specifically developing a technological edge in the Indo-Pacific? On September 20th, the Center for New American Security hosted Professor Tanya Monroe, Australia's chief defense scientist, in conversation with Becca Wasser to discuss the latest developments and challenges under AUKUS Pillar 2. This conversation was a part of the CNAS Mission Brief Speaker Series, which features deep-diving discussions with the military and civilian leaders driving future U.S. and allied defense strategy. You can watch past mission briefs and find out about upcoming ones at cnas.org/events. Here's their conversation.
I'm Becca Wasser, a senior fellow in the defense program here at a Center for New American Security, where I also lead the gaming lab. Thank you so much to our in-person audience for joining us today. And for those of you who are joining us virtually, thank you so much for tuning in. A special shout out to our friends who are joining us from Australia virtually. I understand it's pretty late by you, so that's dedication, and we very much appreciate it. So we have a fantastic conversation planned here today with Professor Tanya Monroe, who is Australia's chief defense scientist. And we're going to talk about a range of topics, you know, how it is that Australia can gain an asymmetric advantage through emerging technologies and advanced defense capabilities, as well as how Pillar 2 of AUKUS technologies fit into that as well. I will say that this event is part of the CNAS Mission Brief Series, which is really just a series of conversations with senior civilian and military leaders, talking about defense strategy and operations, as well as the steps that they are taking today to meet the future challenges of tomorrow. We're going to start off this conversation by talking about the mission brief of the day, the reason why we are all here and the main topic at hand. We're then going to have a conversation about that and a few side issues before moving on to Q&A from the audience. You know, for those in person, just make sure to identify yourself and I'll call on you when we get to that point. For those who are joining us virtually, you know, you've got plenty of ways in which you can ask questions. You can scroll down and use the toolbox at the bottom of the page, or you could use social media, particularly Twitter, and use hashtag CNAS2023 to ask us a question. Again, just please identify yourself so that way you'll know when your question is the one being asked. So without further ado, now that we've gotten all of that administrivia out of the way, let's get started. So Professor Monroe, what is the mission brief today?
Well, today, the mission brief is how can we use science and technology and innovation to really lean in to create asymmetric capability for our nations in this rapidly changing world? And how do we make sure that in doing that, that we're meeting warfighter needs, creating deterrence, and using really the special sauce, which is our alliances?
Well, there's a lot in there, and I'm really looking forward to unpacking that in our conversation. I think let's first, you know, I'm going to first push you on this idea of an asymmetric advantage, but then we can probably link that to the defense strategy. You recently had the Defense Strategic Review come out, as well as, you know, then making that through link to AUKUS Pillar 2 technologies and how that plays in. So tell me a little bit more about this idea of creating an asymmetric advantage. Usually when I talk to folks on the US side, particularly at the US Department of Defense, they tend to talk more about creating a decision-making advantage, right? But instead, we've been talking a little bit more here about an asymmetric advantage. What is that? What does it look like? And how does technology play into it?
Becca, it's a great question. So a decision-making advantage is just one flavour of asymmetric advantage. And really the way I'd characterise asymmetry is it's a mindset shift from defence thinking about capability gaps and how do you fill a capability gap to asking the question, what is it you can do that changes the calculus of actions of a potential adversary? What can you do that might make them question their own approaches? What can you do that might require the application of far more resource or impose cost on a potential adversary? That at the heart is what asymmetry is. It can take many forms. Mm-hmm. It can be technological, it can be decision, it can be information, it can be alliances. But at the heart of it, it's, as I said, that mindset shift from saying we've got a gap, we're outmatched, to saying how do we impose cost and change decision calculus of an adversary?
So with that, that kind of gives us a broad space to talk about technology and advanced defense capabilities. You know, how are those really fitting into how you and your group are building that asymmetric advantage? And, you know, I think it's really smart that you've been talking about allies and partners, right? And about capability gaps, because it doesn't have to be that every single country needs to have all of everything and that it needs to be redundant. There's different ways in which you can work together. And Australia has some core technology areas where you are really at the leading edge. So can you tell us a little bit more about how technology fits into that and some of those key areas where Australia is really leading on advanced defence capabilities?
I guess to frame it, you know, everyone here knows that Australia is a huge continent with a small population. And so we have to be clever about what it is we do, but we would never fight alone. And if we look at where we have advantage, what we need to do is make sure that our scarce resource, our people, smaller in number, mm-hmm. our technology, the smaller scale of our innovation system, is applied judiciously so that the work we do makes a difference, not just to us, because as I said, we'd never fight alone, but makes a difference to our allies. And, you know, the main game, of course, is not to fight at all.
Mm, of course.
Is to deter. And to me, that's where alliances really come to the fore. Because if there's a potential adversary reflecting on, is it time today to make this move? And there's uncertainty as to what we can do together, then that is, I think, the strongest form of deterrence.
I mean, that is music to my ears, in part because this is the core of a lot of my work here at CNAS, is looking at different ways in which we can deter would-be adversaries from future aggression, specifically in the ally and partner context. Dr. Stacey Pettyjohn and I wrote a report that was looking at integrated deterrence with allies and partners, really trying to get at that and looking at the different forms of integration. And a lot of the integration actually is in this sort of technological area, right? It's not just about the technologies alone, but how you can use them, who uses them, where and when. So if I can sort of draw the link between what you're saying and defense strategy. You know, in April, Australia published the Defense Strategic Review, and it lays out a pretty ambitious agenda for force design reform, if you will. And it's quite smart in how it does it, at least the version that I read, which is, you know, identifying different force structure priorities and linking them to both current and future capabilities. So to me, I read that and I said, oh, that probably means a whole heck of a lot for your job and is probably taking up a lot of your time. So what has that meant for you? And what has that meant for different technology priority areas and requirements?
So the DSR, the Defence Strategic Review, is indeed a significant change in posture for Australia. You can see what it means for me by just looking at the early announcement of the top six priorities from the DSR, one of which was innovation, science and technology. And under that, we were given very clear direction of six areas of innovation, science and technology that provide the opportunity for leap ahead. Those areas include long-range fires, directed energy, hypersonics, trusted autonomous systems in all domains, quantum technologies such as, you know, quantum-assisted position navigation and timing and quantum-aided communication technologies, information warfare and automated intelligence. All of these areas have the potential to disrupt the way our forces operate now and allow us to leap ahead technologically so that we can do things differently when we work with our allies. If I look even just to some of the early work that's been done under AUKUS Pillar 2, you know, the advances we've made in being able to bring our AI and automated systems together and together, not separately, manage and control autonomous systems side by side, but pass over control between our autonomous systems. That again creates autonomy because, sorry, it creates asymmetry.
Yeah.
Because it allows us to really embrace that shift from platforms being themselves the deliverer of effects to platforms being essentially data systems that can be integrated.
No, I think that's incredibly, incredibly useful. And I think I recently heard about the initiative that you're describing. I know Indo-PACOM on our side was very much involved in creating some of those networks.
It's probably worth saying that this is, you know, while it's very exciting to see this breakthrough, I'd like to pay credit to the fact that we've had nearly 70 years where our Five Eyes nations have worked in deep partnership on science and technology through a program called the Technical Cooperation Program, TDCP, which has meant that our Five Eyes nations have the benefit of each other's strengths in science and technology, which has had impact, you know, right through from our platforms and protection systems right through to the uniforms that our soldiers, seamen and air folk wear. So to me, that science and technology cooperation between like-minded nations has a very strong foundation. And what AUKUS Pillar 2 allows us to do is to pull that thread through to capability advantage.
No, and I think there's almost two timelines here that we would be talking about, right? One is what you can do today to build on that cooperation that we already have, to try and get technologies that would benefit warfighters into their hands now. In the longer term, we're trying to be a little bit more transformative of what a future force would look like and what an allied force truly would look like. So could you maybe give us some examples of what you're doing today to get, you know, to really meet warfighter needs, as well as what are some of those more longer term technology priority areas? Because it does strike me that they're probably not the same.
They're not the same. But the big transformation we're driving in Australia is to shift the way we construct our innovation science and technology system so that warfighter problems are at the centre of what we do, that they're crafted as problem statements that are technology agnostic, and then allow us to harness the creativity and good ideas of our whole ecosystem. So we had our first attempt at this back in 2020 when we launched our More Together strategy, which at its heart had 8 star shots. These 8 star shots were goals that had come from our chiefs of services saying, in the year 2030, I would like to be able to do the following. And there were 8 different scenarios, from surveil the undersea environment to have resilient constellations of satellites that could withstand onslaught. And each of these was deliberately crafted so because to recognise that we didn't currently have the science and technology at hand to solve these problems. And they've served as a stimulus to the Australian innovation science and technology system because our aim has been to align the work done in our universities and in our industry. It's probably worth reflecting for the American audience. Our innovation ecosystem is a little different. It's obviously to the US system. It's obviously smaller in scale. We're largely a small to medium enterprise economy. We don't have as many of the large companies with research labs as you have here in the US. And the bulk of our research and development happens in our universities, which gave us a tremendous opportunity to try and align that work, which historically has been largely bottom-up, investigator-driven, to these bigger missions, these bigger national missions. But it's also been enormously gratifying to see how that articulation of these big, bold, hairy warfighter problems has helped us align the way we work strategically with our allies as well and change that dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that there's a bunch of efforts ongoing in our various departments of defense to try and align some of those requirements and to work together largely, not only on a bilateral basis, but obviously trilateral involving the United Kingdom as well.
It's probably worth, because I realize I didn't get to all the parts of your earlier question.
I gave you a big one,
well,
sorry.
That's okay, it makes a conversation. So what the DSR, though, signalled was the criticality of making sure that we have the best possible capability for our warfighters if conflict were to happen sooner. And so that has shifted some of our timelines nearer. And we've created something called the Advanced Strategic Capabilities Accelerator, which I described to a US audience as quite a bit of SCO flavour, a lot of DARPA, and a sprinkling of DIU. And I'd like to pay tribute to all my friends and colleagues in DARPA, SCO and DIU for really having those rich conversations with us as we figured out how to make something like this work for Australia. But at the heart of ASCA, which was announced in the Defence Strategic Review, is the idea that these problem statements that I described as being first tested in the Australian context through our starshots now are about missions that can be demonstrated in a militarily relevant environment in 2 to 3 years. So where, again, we take these technology agnostic problem statements and we pull together consortia from across our ecosystem to deliver. Now, we've deliberately constructed this so that some of the problem statements we tackle in ASCA can help accelerate and deliver on AUKUS Pillar 2 initiatives, working with the innovation systems from the UK and the US, which is very exciting. ASCA started operation on 1 July, and to try and get something out fast, we tackled something even nearer term. So in order to deal with the fact that it's no longer acceptable risk-wise to use DJI drones, we put out a call to the Australian ecosystem to say, what do you have that might contribute to a sovereign drone ecosystem? We got over 250 responses from Australia, everything from complete systems to components to software, and are looking to see how we can address some of the simpler UAS types of uses across our forces in a sovereign way. Of course, that doesn't rule out working closely with allies, but it was the first of these calls, and that's obviously a little bit more DIU-like. One of the measures of success I put on us was to try and tap into industry that doesn't ordinarily work with defence, and the signs are good. And I know that's part of the DIU mission. So as I said, a sprinkling of DIU in there too.
Yeah, no, it's great. Half the time it's about getting the right folks in the room to understand what they already have and what they're working on and how that can be leveraged for the problems that we all share. I'm going to transition us now to talking about AUKUS Pillar 2 in full, because let's be honest, I think that's really the topic that's on everyone's brain. So we recently had the second anniversary of the AUKUS announcement, which, great, very exciting. But again, the focus seems to really be on Pillar 1 and the delivery of the submarines. And for me, I still have these big questions about Pillar 2, because that's actually the area that I see the most opportunity. And there's so much promise in that. So since we're now moving into this second year, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about some of the progress that we're making on the Pillar 2 technology areas, which are, I will add, rather large and wide-ranging.
Yeah, look, one of the challenges Pillar 2 has is it's somewhat more diffuse and amorphous than Pillar 1, which is easy to get your head around, harder to deliver, but easy to get your head around. In Pillar 2, It's been extraordinary watching our three nations bring together their experts, not just their scientists, but the user community as well, to come together to really understand where we have relative strengths and where we can really lean in to enhance mutual reliance. This has given us clarity on what we can do together, what we're best bringing to the party, and where we need to focus. From now, with Pillar 2, what we are doing is making sure that the technologies, because of course within Pillar 2, the way the working groups are structured has been along technology lines on the whole, rather than along the lines of warfighter needs. So what that has had really significant attention is how do we get, to use the language I've been using thus far in the conversation, the problem statements, the requirements from each of our three operational headquarters at the fore, and make sure that that technology development done under each of those working groups aligns with our warfighters' highest priority problems. And that has been a bit of a forcing function for winnowing down what we do. And, you know, I think one of the challenges Pillar 2 will always have is, I think, in the medium term to long term, the biggest impact we'll have on deterrence or the calculus of conflict will be disruptive technology. You know, it'll be having, you know, uncrewed submarines that can lurk and threaten to deliver effects. You know, it'll be having ways of making an adversary question their own decisions. All of these things are slightly more amorphous and less tangible than a big shiny submarine. And, you know, by its very nature, we have to be very deliberate about what we conceal and what we reveal. Mm-hmm. And I think AUKUS gives us a really powerful new way to do that, not as nations, but together. So I know you will see some announcements to come, and I'm really proud of the teams and the way really the AUKUS working groups have eliminated the boundaries between our nations in terms of trust and collaboration, and some of the congressional changes that we're hoping will push through will, I think, then make it possible for our industries too to augment each other, not just our warfighters and our scientists.
So you mentioned two things that I want to come back to. The first thing that I want to pull out is announcements to come. Heidi Shu recently gave a speech where she said that in the fall, and I would believe we have transitioned into fall, we should expect a big AUKUS Pillar 2 announcement. Do you have anything that you can share on that, or at least give us any hint?
I don't want to get ahead of our governments. That's very career limiting. But I would say that I have been just ever so grateful to Heidi for the very, very deep partnership. That I would say that it's not overstating it to say that through working with Heidi, we've made a substantial mindset shift in the way Australia and the US work together. From seeing Australia as a valid ally and an augmentation of the science and technology base of the US, to being that phrase I used earlier, enhanced mutual reliance. And in cases where Australia has some niche technology edge, which is either driven by our unique circumstances or our R&D excellence, the US is leaning in and integrating those elements with US systems rather than learning from it and reinventing it. And you know, the very fact that Heidi has been out to Australia both this year and last year, I think pays tribute to the depth of that relationship. But I don't want to get ahead of our governments in announcements.
That's fair. I was being a little cheeky by trying to see what I could get. But, you know, you did mention some of the ways in which, you know, there's been this development of trust and being able to collaborate and really integrate, that key word of integration. But, you know, there are still so many potential barriers to Pillar 2 success, right? We, you know, I can sort of tick off a bunch off the top of my head. You know, there's U.S. export controls. ITAR is a four-letter word in pretty much every single sense and meaning. You know, information sharing, you know, getting over the valley of death when we're looking at some of, you know, our innovation ecosystem, you know, funding. Which ones are getting in your way? And what are you trying to do to mitigate some of that to enhance the trilateral collaboration in Pillar 2 technologies?
Look, there's no question that if the congressional changes and the respective changes in each of our AUKUS nations needed to get that in place go through, that will be the biggest shift we've experienced in our ability to operationalize our alliance. There's, you know, in many ways, the fact that we all work in different ways, in different systems, at different scales, with different financial years, is not necessarily a bad thing. And really what I've observed has been critical to get some of the momentum into AUKUS Pillar 2 has been not seeing it as a bolt-on, not seeing it as some new separate activity, but actually seeing it as a way of getting after things that are priorities for each of our nations. And that, for me, is part of the shift that's helping us now get some momentum.
And that's a positive way that you can approach it. You know, it also seems as though we talk a lot about the ways in which we can have genuine co-development and co-production of technologies and even co-sustainment down the line. But, you know, there has been some struggles to making that happen. There's a lot of different ideas as to how you can get over that, this idea of potentially, you know, born exportable capabilities. Is this something that you're thinking about to try and consider how you can make these Pillar 2 technologies and essentially to have them be successes right from the outset rather than having to deal with some of these traditional boundary barriers to collaboration?
It's probably worth starting my answer to that question by saying there's been a really rich and deep and long history of co-dev between the US and Australia, whether it's the Mark 48 torpedoes, some of the hypersonics work. Mm-hmm. We've worked together over many, many, many decades to bring the best of both nations together to develop capability. Where it's been less successful because of those rules, regulations, and national four-letter words has been in that real co-production, co-sustainment piece. Now, Australia's location in the world, in one of the most dynamic and changing part of our geopolitical parts of the world, makes us incredibly well positioned to lean into areas such as co-sustainment. And, you know, one side reflection I'll make is, I don't know how many in this audience know about the forum called ADAC, but it's where the science principles and the acquisition principles of both of our nations come together. And when I first started in this role almost 5 years ago, it was really two parallel streams. The scientists would talk to the scientist and the acquisition folk would talk to the acquisition folk and we'd come together and talk next to each other. And what has shifted over that time is it now is integrated. We're now talking about how we shift those barriers in co-production and co-sustainment, take advantage of unique geography, unique industrial bases, go beyond seeing a different nation augmenting one nation's or industrial base's competition and make it instead resilience.
Yeah, resilience is definitely the name of the game as we start looking for ways of strengthening our respective defense industrial bases. I just want to remind our virtual audience to please keep questions coming. We're probably going to move to audience Q&A quite shortly once I get through all of my AUKUS questions, because I'm going to be selfish and continue to ask them. Sorry, y'all. So there's been a lot of discussion about how in some of the working groups, there might be opportunities to expand them to include other countries. South Korea has been mentioned. Japan has also been mentioned as potential, you know, participants. Do you see that in the offing? Do you think that that would be a net positive? Or do you think that there are other venues for collaboration with those countries and others, and that, you know, sort of what's under this AUKUS, you know, umbrella should probably remain the three nations for now?
So I'll start this one with saying that our partnerships, and I'll talk from an Australian perspective, obviously, but I suspect there's many parallels. Having seen, in fact, overnight, some lovely photos of Heidi Shu meeting with her Japanese counterparts and progressing bilateral partnerships there. We have very close relationships with Japan and South Korea and, of course, Canada and New Zealand. Many of our nations that share values and deep intent to be partnered both in defence operations but also in defence science, technology and innovation. The question of when would it be the right time and if it would be the right thing to bring other nations into AUKUS really is a trade-off between operationalising AUKUS so that it can quickly deliver warfighter advantage and tackling some of those broader challenges that come with more nations involved. And so I think it's the right thing at this moment in time for us to really focus on making the best we can from our three nations, while in parallel leaning deeply into our other alliances. I don't see it's an either-or, but I don't think it's necessarily going to help us move faster if we try and bring those broader alliances into the AUKUS family. Yeah. Too soon.
Too soon. Not either-or, but it's a yes and.
Yes.
And I think that that's fairly promising. I'm going to end my set of questions, at least, with what I think is a fun one, but it's also probably a tough one, which is, you know, I mentioned before that some of the technology areas mentioned under Pillar 2, it is a bit of a laundry list, and it's a very wide-ranging laundry list for good measure, right? Some of it, again, is this question of timelines. What do you need to, you know, what can you work on that can be delivered now? And what are some of the longer term priority technologies? But if you had to pick three that you believe are the most important and the most impactful,
yes,
what would they be?
What a great question. So firstly, autonomy. Autonomy, taking the human from danger, having the ability to deliver strategic surprise. That for me is going to change the calculus of deterrence and conflict. And I think we've only just seen the beginning. And in fact, if you look at Ukraine, you know, I saw recent reports of cardboard drones from an Australian company, in fact, in the Ukraine. So, you know, it's interesting. And the next I would say is the whole information environment, information warfare, automated intelligence products, the ability to be able to take that information domain, understand it, control it, and ensure that in that sub-threshold grey zone, we're doing what we can to deter. Then my view is that there will be very significant disruption coming from quantum technologies, whether that's just simply some of the work that's advancing very quickly across our AUKUS and Five Eyes nations to make sure that we can still have position, navigation, timing data in a GPS or GNSS denied environment, right through to the promise of quantum computing. They're the three areas I'd pick.
And those are all great areas where I know that there's a lot going on with all of our respective countries. You know, for my sins, I keep on trying to understand exactly what quantum is. And we've got a very smart research assistant here, Sam Howell, who I keep on begging to explain to me. And she's the quantum expert. And every single time I come to her, she's like, you're not quite there yet. But eventually I'll understand. But I do know that it has a lot of promise for what we're doing, you know, in the here and now, as well as in the future.
And it's interesting, actually, it is an area where Australia has outsized heft. For historic and investment and leadership reasons, we have an unusually strong quantum ecosystem, both in our universities and in our SMEs.
And that's great, because part of the whole theory of the case here is the ways in which we can all work together to take advantage of each other's strengths. So I'm now going to shift to asking some questions from the audience. I'm going to ask one from our virtual audience first before moving to folks in the room. So this question comes from Christian. Considering how much the commercial sector drives innovation, how does the government and defense nudge the system in a direction that warfighters need? As one author suggests, the CEO of Apple may have more influence than anyone in the Defense Department.
It's a great question. I think what we need to get a lot better at, and I'm particularly talking about in the Australian context, which, as I said, has somewhat of a different shape and size industrially, is getting much better at getting those warfighter problems, those priority warfighter problems out and communicated at appropriate levels. We can't afford to have our industry guessing what we're going to want and ploughing money, time, people into solutions that are not quite what's going to shift the needle. So in Australia, our need is to really bring industry in to the tent with us in making sure that they understand our highest priority problems.
Hi, I'm Sydney Friedberg from Breaking Defense, a news website founded by a man who's now in Australia, actually.
Oh, cool.
But you mentioned ITAR, the four-letter word. There is an ITAR, I think a charmingly named koala bill to loosen ITAR vis-a-vis Australia.
Very Aussie imagery.
Yes. As opposed to the poisonous spider bill, I suppose. The question would be, as the U.S. Congress, as the State Department, as the Pentagon all look at ways to reform the laws, reform the regulations, what would you urge your American interlocutors to do to change those systems, ITAR and others, to make AUKUS more realizable, to operationalize it, as you put it?
Thank you. That was a wonderful question. My view is if we can take the intent that is so clearly there at senior ranks of the DoD and through this reform drive that through the system, that's what we need. Because I've had up close and personal experience where leaders responsible for certain areas of technology have given direction that, certain fields of endeavour are not to be no-fawn. That Australia, for example, is to be brought in because we have something to offer that will help accelerate what the US is doing. And yet it still gets strangled and frozen because of very rational human fears of people within the system that they will be personally liable and accountable for those decisions that go against the culture and precedent of keeping other nations out. So I think really what I would urge is a really mature conversation about the advantage to the US from this ITAR reform. The advantage to the US in having a more broad base of innovation, science and technology, the advantage to the US in having more resilience in supply chains and sustainment opportunities, and really recognize that senior intent is not enough unless it is driven through the systems that deliver on that senior intent. It is a cultural matter.
Okay, any other?
And what gives me enormous heart, I would say, if I may, is the long history we have of our men and women in uniform working alongside each other with trust. That's what we aspire to bring to our whole ecosystem.
Thanks. Jennifer Maroney from RAND. Quick question. The group that you head, DST Group, I wonder if you might talk a little bit about what DSTG has been doing in the Pillar 2 space.
Yeah, thanks. Fantastic. Really happy to. So DST Group has many counterpart and equivalent organizations in the US, where essentially all of the government defense labs and all of the FFRDCs all rolled into one organization, which it's my great privilege to head. It's 116 years old this year. So what DSTG does is provide the deep subject matter experts across the range of all of the Pillar 2 technologies. So our contributions range from providing the leaders for some of the working groups in areas such as quantum, or I lead the innovation working group from Australia because of my experience. And in other cases where we might have a service lead one of the working groups, we provide those subject matter experts who can harness what we have within DST Group. I charge my leaders within DST Group not to only be the experts in these warfighter relevant technologies, but to actually understand the national ecosystem. They're charged with going out there, making those long-term partnerships and understanding what we've got in our SMEs and in our universities. And so they've been able to bring some of that thinking to our AUKUS Pillar 2 work as well.
So I'm going to now move to a question from one of our virtual viewers. And Stephen asks, in contrast to the United States, Australia has developed a reputation for developing and growing a pipeline of STEM professionals. What lessons can the United States learn from Australia as it strives to develop more robust STEM talent?
I think I'd start by saying we think it is a problem we have not solved. And I am deeply worried about the fact that now we have less than 10% of our young girls and boys doing the more advanced maths courses at school. You know, there are some significant systemic issues, which I think at their heart come down to culture and a lack of understanding of how much future opportunity, future jobs will be based on STEM expertise and qualifications. That said, some of the things we've done that have been really, really fabulous in the defence context, we have a cadet program. You know, it gets students in their undergraduate courses the opportunity to come in and work on real problems and get a sense of both, you know, that motivation to continue their studies, but what they can do inside defence science. Probably the program I'm most excited about recently is something called the Navigate program. But just as a quick bit of context, coming in as Chief Defence Scientist, it really struck me as I was giving out 40-year service awards, 50-year service awards, and recently a 60-year service award to a bloke at 82 who'd been working with us since he was 22. Quite something, yeah?
Wow.
That the people in DST Group are committed, they're passionate, they're knowledgeable. But that if we were going to align the capability of the nation and work in a different way with our universities, work in a different way with our entrepreneurs and SMEs, we needed to bring in people from those different walks of life into our organisation, and we needed to send our people out into that ecosystem. So the Navigate program is a mid-career grad program. And it brings people in between 5 and 15 years of a PhD or equivalent experience and says to them, you don't need to know what a good job for you would be in defence. What you need to do is come in and do a couple of rotations, taste it, try it, and trust us that we only picked you because you're a high achiever and we know you can make a difference. So we've now run that once, and we've just, in the recruitment for the second round, we've got nearly 1,000 applicants in both rounds, because I think it tugs on something about people wanting to contribute to the nation. But the other thing that's really helped is diversity. In the first round, we sit in my organisation at about 25% women, 20% in the STEM roles, and it's not good enough and it's not shifting. And so in this Navigate program, we said we target 40% women, and we got 43% women by doing nothing other than signalling. So for all our intake programs now, we've said that we target 50% women, because I fundamentally believe, and I'm only talking about one diversity group, but I fundamentally believe that if your teams, whether that's your leadership teams or your working groups, don't represent your broader population, then factors other than talent are at play.
Absolutely. Sometimes it is just merely being there that makes a difference, as well as letting folks know that that is an opportunity that's available to them, right? It's that signal, as you say. I believe we had a question over here.
Thank you both so much. I'm Brandy Vincent with Defense Scoop. I had some follow-up questions on your OSCA accelerator that you shared. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the investments made to make it real. Like, mm-hmm. how are you funding it? Mm-hmm. What's next in terms of problem statements beyond the drones? That was a great example, but could you give some others? And then is there any room for collaboration with Defense Department, U.S. Defense Department accelerators as well?
Great question. So OSCA has an initial commitment of $3.4 billion over the decade. Billion. It does bring together our historic defence innovation programs into one coordinated defence innovation program. And the next set of problem statements has just been endorsed by our Vice Chief of our Defence Force and is in the process of being worked out for release. And we're working through the process of which of the problem statements press an AUKUS button or another bilateral or multilateral piece. So you can understand there's a little bit of work between us deciding what's most important to us and us deciding what we're doing alone and what we're doing together. But the intent with those is very much to go out and use them a bit like we have with the Starshots to elicit what there is in our ecosystems that can come to them. Learning from DARPA, one of the things we do when we go out with the problem statements will be to get those program managers from the ecosystem. I'm quite determined that that's a method for us to build those deeper ties and connections with our system. And I think, you know, looking back at DARPA, that's been one of the extraordinary successes of that approach. So please watch this space. They're expected to come out this year.
Fantastic. We've got a really interesting question from Jill, who's one of our virtual viewers. And Jill asks, could you please comment on Australia's semiconductor industry, which isn't something that we've talked about yet today. Talk about Australia's semiconductor industry as a complement to the United States and other allies' efforts to secure supply lines and diversify sources of production. And also has the follow-up question of, is AUKUS or the Quad a better home to deepen partnerships in this really critical area?
Wow, that could almost be a whole conversation in itself. What I would say is Australia's semiconductor industry is very small and very niche. But it's interesting. What is very lively in our nation at the moment is it's the conversation about critical minerals. You know, we have such national wealth of all sorts of critical minerals. And yet we have this historic tendency to just dig things up and send them off for value add. The questions of what we can do onshore for value add and what in doing that creates security of supply lines for our allies as well as ourselves is a very, very hot topic in Australia right now. There's, I think, great potential there, but I don't think it's anything we can do alone. Mm-hmm. And I think many of the things we've talked about today, such as AUKUS Pillar 2, will help cement some of the value propositions as Australia works down that path of deciding what it can do.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to ask, with the SME culture and sort of economy, as you mentioned, that Australia has, what do you think is the best model to sustain them, grow them if they want to, and to make sure that the primes from the UK and the US, particularly on AUKUS, but also maybe just writ large, don't absorb them, where they have to give away their intellectual property, which is something that makes them incredibly nervous. What do you think that looks like? What can primes do in the UK and the US to support SME economy and industry? What's the best formula, you think, for that?
It's such a hard question. I think there's no one formula. I think one of the best ways, and it's something we see in our Ghost Shark program. I don't know how many are aware of that. This is our work with a newly formed company, Anduril Australia, and well over 30 SMEs in the Australian ecosystem to develop extra large uncrewed submarines. It's a wonderful model in that it starts out from the beginning to assemble that pipeline of SMEs to cover the range of technologies required and to give them some degree of resilience. through working in that cooperative fashion, I think it's always going to be a challenge to avoid that sense of threat for SMEs from the primes. And in many ways, I've been reflecting that the whole ASCA model we're taking in Australia, done well, is to a degree a threat to primes, because we're taking a role of integrating the capacity of SMEs in a way that I think historically Australia has always expected and needed primes to do for us. And it's not to say that won't continue into the future, but I think the balance will shift and that we need to take a more proactive role in working with our SMEs and integrating them together, whether it's with companies like Anduril or whether it's directly with our department.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments thus far. Trent Telford, Cocoon Data. We're an Australian and US-based security company. Question for you around the Pillar 2 aspects. A lot of discussion today about autonomy, the autonomous landscape, unmanned, uncrewed, I should say, submarines, et cetera, et cetera. That whole change in the connected battlefield has one common thread. It's connectivity and it's security. Having a swarm of autonomous capability is terrific as long as it can connect and there isn't poisonous data injected into those networks by our adversaries. So, you know, historically, right back to DARPA, we've had a 30-year view of the internet and security being network-based rather than data-centric-based. I'm interested to understand how the Pillar 2 working groups are thinking about the connectivity, really, to this landscape and also interoperability, as we have to bring, you know, different partners either within AUKUS, within Five Eyes or other nations in and out of a conflict for a moment in time and make all that happen without, quite frankly, the adversaries getting involved. So it's kind of the boring part of it, right? But unless you do it, it's all that autonomy has a lot less asymmetric capability.
Look, it's a very, very good point. And even in some of the early demonstrations and early work of the working groups under Pillar 2, by simply bringing together our three nation systems and finding the ways to have them, as I said earlier, not just work side by side, but actually work in a more integrated way, we're already tackling some of those questions. I think it'll only increasingly become a critical factor into the future. And that's why when I was asked by Becca what I saw as the three top areas of focus, I'd put the information domain right up there. Because really, our ability to operate is only as good as our ability to trust the data that passes between our platforms, whether they're autonomous or whether they're crewed. So I think it is increasingly the pressing issue of our times. And, you know, as we move to things like zero trust data environments and the like, we need to make sure we do it in a way that, you know, not only we're thinking about things like standards and how they're set and how that plays to the benefit of allies, but how we can use the diversity of systems that we have without requiring them to all be the same. And so I'm glad there are companies like yours that are working in this space across our nations, but the reality is that there's a long way to go. I'm a very firm advocate, and you may have got a sense of this from the examples I've given, of using pipe cleaners to help change cultures, change approaches and the like. So I think the way we will crack this is one program at a time in terms of raising our level of understanding of what the role of government is and what industry needs to support us in that.
Well, on that note, I think we are running out of time. So I'm going to ask you, if you could, to recap what today's mission brief is and why it's important.
Thank you, Becca. And thank you to everybody online and in the room for wonderful and thought-provoking questions. I know I'll take them away with me too. For me, there's nothing better able to deliver asymmetry than our partnerships. And the sooner we can have our nations, our allied nations, particularly our AUKUS nations and our Five Eyes nations and other key alliances, able to go from deep, strong, trusted, sharing of values and serving side by side in conflict or in exercises, to really being able to integrate our innovation, our science, our technology, and our industrial bases, the greater our deterrence capacity and the greater we'll be able to deliver asymmetry to help avoid conflict, or if conflict comes, to be able to be decisive. So I think I thank everyone who's with good faith helping to really change the paradigms and the cultures we work within. I know that there's a groundswell of amazing technologies being developed between our nations that can drive industrial development in our countries if we are able to push through some of the changes that are afoot at the moment. And I'm very excited about that.
Well, let me echo that thanks. Thank you to our virtual audience. Thank you to our in-person audience. And last but not least, thank you to you, Professor Monroe. This has been a fantastic discussion, and I am so looking forward to seeing where AUKUS Pillar 2 in particular ends up going. And I'll still wait for that announcement that they say is forthcoming. But, you know,
maybe everyone... we can talk then.
Okay, good. But, you know, again, everyone, thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, folks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CNES Live, a production of the Center for a New American Security. This episode was produced by Anna Peterson and Charles Horn, with design help from Melody Cook and Ren Rothback. Please rate and subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts.